All right, this is Gary Barrett from CBS Sports, and it's now Sunday, January 24th, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I got Matt Norlander with me, I got Sam Vecini with me, and it was a wild weekend of college basketball. You guys get through it okay? You get through this wild weekend of college basketball okay?
I'm doing all right. I mean, it was an enjoyable weekend, and you know, it was part of the wildness was it wasn't a complete devastation of ranked teams. You know, a little bit of a reversion to expectations, relatively speaking, to what we've seen in the past 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, I guess the only top five team to lose this weekend, or maybe there were, well, Maryland, right? And then where was SMU ranked? Because the headlines
Eighth,
of the week,
I think.
Okay, so the headlines of the weekend. Let's just run through them real quick, and then we'll pop into them however we feel like. Providence won at Villanova. That was obviously a huge game in the overtime. SMU took its first loss at Temple. Iowa moved to 7-0 in the Big Ten with a sweep of Purdue and a sweep of Michigan State. Indiana moved to 7-0 in the Big Ten. Their resume isn't nearly as impressive as Iowa's. They haven't played the same caliber of teams yet, but still, you know, they were sitting there in a pretty rough spot once upon a time, and now they're 7-0 in the Big Ten. Michigan State snapped its three-game losing streak. They beat Maryland Saturday night at the Breslin Center. I'll start with you, Sam. What was the biggest development of the weekend? What's the biggest headline of the weekend? If we could only talk about one thing from college basketball from Saturday or Sunday, which of these things would it be?
It's probably SMU, right? I mean, there's no longer an undefeated team in college basketball. They ran into a juggernaut of shooting with Temple on Sunday. And that's kind of a problem that SMU has had all season long. They've given up a lot of threes throughout the season. I think they're 328th in the country in the percentage of shots that teams take against them that are threes. And if you know anything about three-point defense, the best way to actually guard against three-pointers is just not allow teams to take them. That's how teams like Brown dropped 15 threes on them. Temple dropped 14 today. I think Michigan dropped 10 on them earlier this year. And that's how you lose games, pure and simple. I mean, if a team gets hot from three, you can have the best team in the world and you can still end up losing games. And, you know, this was a great run for SMU. It was going to come to an end eventually, just because at this point, I think they only have 7 scholarship players. And that's obviously incredibly difficult to deal with. Just, I think they're practicing 4-on-4 right now is something I heard. So it's a great accomplishment for them to go 18-0. They're still clearly the favorite in the American Athletic Conference. And hopefully they can, you know, finish up something like, you know, 26-2. I think they have 28 games this year. So 26-2, something like that. And, you know, that'd be a really great story.
I will say it'll be interesting to see how you motivate these guys now, because obviously when you have no postseason opportunities, there can be like a little bit of what are we even playing for mindset that slips in. But then you get, you know, to 18-0, and in a weird way, and we've talked about this before, you go from having nothing to play for to having something really significant to play for. Like, you're playing for history. Like, man, like, we're halfway, more than halfway to an undefeated season. And no, I think it would have actually been 30, you know, I think they've got 30 games. And no, it wouldn't have been an undefeated team season like 76 Indiana, because it wouldn't have resulted in a national title. But still, we would have remembered that team forever. Like, I talked about this on a radio show, not mine, but somebody else's, on Friday. You know, like, I think you guys can probably do this, but the casual sports fan couldn't. Like, okay, national champion 1991, national champion 1996, national champion 2001.
Okay. To that Duke.
2007.
Florida.
2011.
Doesn't UConn?
You're really good at this, right? Sam, could you?
I could not do that.
I couldn't do that either, right? My point is, they kind of blur together except for the really special ones. Like, you know, the back-to-back Floridas, 05, 09 Carolina, 2012 Kentucky, 2008 Kansas. But you can get into some of these years where it's like, whatever. I mean, you know, we give away a trophy every year. But, like, you would remember 30-0 SMU forever, right? That's a fair point.
I think that's totally fair. Go ahead, Sam.
I will say this. I don't know for a fact that we would. I mean, the first year that Urban Meyer took over at Ohio State, they go undefeated. They're not eligible for the championship game, obviously. And I feel like that team's been kind of forgotten over the course of the last.
But I would. Okay, I mean, so here's my.
It's more difficult in college right. basketball for right. sure.
Well, I mean, yeah, one because the short seasons are shorter. Two, because Meyer's own program has overshadowed that accomplishment with what That's they've true. Done, winning a national championship since. With SMU, you've got obviously a legendary coach. I understand Meyer's also that, but SMU has no basketball history whatsoever, and the fact that you've got the NCAA tie to Larry Brown, and going 30-0, it would also mark. The third straight season, which we would have had a team run the table in the regular season in college basketball, Kentucky last year, Wichita State the year before. Yep. I think we would have remembered that team for a long time. Now, you know, it is what it is.
I do too, and here's why. Because we get undefeated seasons in football, all college football, all the time. Like, it's not only Urban Meyer's Ohio mm-hmm. State team, it's Urban Meyer's Utah team. It's Tulane once upon a time with Sean King at quarterback. We always I remember that one. It's you know, it's Jameis Winston at Florida State. Whereas we don't get undefeated. See, you know, a team that finishes undefeated. I know technically it would just be an undefeated regular season, but it would be a team that never lost its entire year. Where Wichita right. State, you know, ultimately took a loss. Kentucky ultimately took a loss. This team would have finished 30-0 if it, you know, could finish 30-0. And so mm-hmm. I think it would have been remembered in a weird way, but in a real way forever. And now that's off the board. And like, what can you get the kids to keep? Can you now, you know, redefine the goal? Can Larry look at those kids and say, okay, now we're playing for the American Athletic Conference championship. That's the new goal. Like, does that get you going? I don't know. But that it'll be interesting to see how they respond to this, because I think we all thought that they'd probably take a loss somewhere along the way, but we didn't necessarily think it'd be at Temple on a Sunday afternoon. You said something, Sam, that I found interesting, and I'm about to ask a question. I don't know the answer to it, but it's something I noticed recently, and it's been in my head. You mentioned that, you know, SMU gave up a bunch of three-pointers, and is there any data? I mean, I'm sure it's available. I just haven't looked it up. Are teams making more three-pointers now? Are they shooting more three-pointers now, making more three-pointers now?
They are shooting more.
Because
they're definitely shooting more.
It seems like here's why I say that. I'm constantly looking at box scores, right? I stare at box scores, because like when we're in studio for television, I don't know if you know this, I don't want to give away secrets, but we're doing highlights on like 20 games. And we don't get to watch 20 games. It's not possible. So you end up having to pick out little bullet points, and it comes off sounding like you were watching the game, but like really you would just grab the box score maybe 14 seconds before you started doing the highlights. And so I'm constantly looking at three-pointers made, three-pointers attempted. And it used to be a big deal, like if somebody made 10 three-pointers, like they made 10 three-pointers. And now it feels like every night, every team that wins makes 10 three-pointers. I know that's not true, but I have noticed, I feel like I've noticed, teams making – obviously taking more but also making more three-pointers than I can remember in college basketball.
Yeah. I mean, they're definitely taking more and making more. I mean, I think that's kind of an analytical revolution over the last few years. I mean, more than anything, you look at the teams that Fred Hoiberg had at Iowa State, they used to take just about zero mid-range shots. And I mean, the mid-range shot in especially college basketball, where the three-point line is so short, I mean, the mid-range shot is, it's not useless, don't get me wrong, but like it has considerably less expected value than a three-point shot or a layup. And I think that teams are getting smarter about their shot distribution on the floor. Like, look at Providence this season. I mean, everyone on Providence can shoot threes. Everyone on Providence can get to the hole and make shots. And they shoot what I feel like from just watching them. And I don't know what their shot distribution looks like off the top of my head as far as like looking at a shot chart. But I would guess that they're pretty close to just taking layups and threes, or at least as close as you can get to that. So I think that that's an example of, you know, the way teams are going forward, thinking analytically just about what the most efficient shots are on the floor.
You know, I wonder why more schools like even the big time programs haven't really just completely committed to it. Like a school like Carolina, Kansas, Kentucky, obviously they're all doing okay. So like, you know, they don't need my advice. But I think it'd be interesting in college basketball to see a program that can go out and like, you know, handpick players. You know, that like, you know, most schools can't, you know, they have to go recruit guys and beat it. You know, the Kansases, Kentuckys, the Carolinas, like they can get high level guys consistently. I wonder what would happen if you, in say a 5-man class at like Kansas, Kentucky, Carolina, Duke. You took, the three all around best talents like you normally would. You know, they're like amazing athletes. You know, future, lottery picks. You know, McDonald's All Americans. And then you just said, you know what? And beyond that, I'm going to sign two or even just one. Just the best shooter in the country. I don't care if he projects as a pro. I don't care if he's a great athlete. I just want to have a couple of just knockdown shooters on my court with these other amazing prospects. And I wonder if you can start to play a style that would be more similar to the way a lot of NBA teams are playing now. Does that make sense, or am I just being silly here?
Well, you're kind of speaking with the way that my man Rick Bird has coached for a long time. And
no, that's 100% right.
No coincidence that McKillop's offense isn't exactly what I think we're getting at here, but certainly the schemes that he runs, and he's never been shy from the three-pointer, and obviously there's the Steph Curry connection right there. I think Beeline does that quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I'm not opposed to this philosophy being adopted in college basketball because I think there is value to that. But I also think a lot of people don't like this at all. And I think it's some of what Mark Jackson was criticizing. Mark Jackson said something like 3 weeks back that I think people took the quote on face value and didn't take it within context. And he was kind of, people thought that he was hating on Curry and the Warriors. And obviously there's the subtext of him coaching the team back when. but really what he was saying was, it's not all good to have college or pro basketball turn into this situation where you have teams jacking up 43 pointers a game, because within that, the sport loses a certain element of dynamics to the style of play. And I think there is something to that. Personally, I like freewheeling offenses. I love the 3-point line. I would think that the college basketball 3-point line could even afford to come back even just a little bit more. And I think that will happen at some point over the next decade. But I think what GP's talking about here also is a little bit easier said than done, because there's just no guarantee that, one, you're going to win those battles on the recruiting trail, and then, two, they're going to totally fit in. It can happen, and don't get me wrong, like what Oklahoma is doing right now is certainly working out to a large extent. But I wonder how much we're going to go to that more and more at the college level. I think you will see it more. But I don't think it's going to take over the sport the way maybe it really is starting to, and the Warriors have started a revelation in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, like Oklahoma, though. Like, I think the best – I don't know if they're the best team in the country. I think they've got the best resume in the country. They're ranked number one at KenPom right now. They shoot 46.4% from three-point range. Like, they're leading the country.
They're awesome. And, yeah, and, like, some of this stuff – like it's ridiculous. Like Buddy Hield, what is he at right now? I'm bringing it up right. I mean, it's just stupid.
He's like, he's like 50, 52% right?
52% from 3-point range.
Yeah.
Like it's outrageous. Like honestly,
I think he's 50-50-90 or right around there, right?
It's crazy, yeah. Right?
It's like 50-50-87, I think.
Yeah. And I love it. Don't get me wrong, but like when you've got a Buddy Hield. Okay, so I did this about 3 weeks ago. I'd have to look it up again. There was only one other guy, and I know it, and I can't think of it off the top of my head. The point I'm making is only one other person had shot more three-pointers than Buddy Hield, or within the same amount of three-pointers, and at the time it was more than 100, and now we're at Buddy Hield's taking 143 and made more than 48% of his shots. It's just insane. Like, it's one thing to be a 50% three-point shooter and you've taken 60 all season and you're really just a spot-up guy like what Max Hooper does at Oakland. But Buddy Hield's taken 143 and made 74. That's insane, and I love it. It's great. But to replicate that is obviously so much easier said than done.
Well, here's the thing about that, though. Like, the idea of, like, the analytical revolution, though, is that you don't really have to shoot 50% from three for the three-pointer to be an efficient shot.
That's the thing.
You
just have to take a bunch. Like,
right.
Like there really is
40% from three is better than 50% from two.
No, basically. But like, you know, like last year, if you looked at, I think the Eastern Conference Finals and the Western Conference Finals, the four teams that were alive were like top seven in the league in three-pointers attempted. Not just that, make them whatever, but like they were taking a bunch, and it creates spacing, and like it's, you know. Because I where I live, I watch the Grizzlies every night, and they can't shoot the ball. But it's not only that they can't make threes; it's that they don't even take them, and it's a problem to not. You have to at least take them, and I think it's actually harder to construct in the NBA because like you're sort of reliant on the draft and you're reliant on free agency. And if you're a small market, you might not be able to, or you don't have like Tim Duncan and Greg Popovich or LeBron. Like it might be hard to lure free agents. Whereas, you know, in this hypothetical I'm talking about, your Kansas and your Kentucky and your North Carolina, like you can go grab, like, let's say there's a kid ranked 55th in the country. And you could get three guys that are ranked higher, but this kid might be a 45% 3-point shooter in college. Just go take him and put him on the court with the rest of your dudes. And like, I don't know. I look at some of these programs that can handpick recruits and I wonder, like you have 13 scholarships and you have no shooters. Like, how does this happen? Yeah. Like John Calipari ends up in that spot all the time. He's got 13 scholarship players, 7 pros, and 1 shooter, and sometimes no shooters. Like I that's always sort of baffled me. Like why these programs that can, like Kentucky right now shooting 32% from 3, ranked 270th in the country. Like why these programs that can sign basically anybody they want end up with rosters with no shooters in this era of basketball?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if you look at another like traditional blue blood, Indiana,
right?
Indiana, I think is, I just looked it up. It's right around 101 shots of theirs have been from the mid range out of like 1,173. And that, you know, that's like 10% of their shots, 9% of their shots. I mean, they're all coming from 3 and they're all coming from within like 7 feet of the basket. Right. Like that's the way that really you should play basketball if you're getting efficient offense and really doing the right things and getting the right motions offensively. Yeah, it just makes so much more sense to play like that. And I think that also a team that I wrote about this weekend in Vanderbilt is a team that is not doing that right mm-hmm. now and is incredibly frustrating to me because they run all of these damn post-ups for, you know, Damian Jones and for Luke Kornet instead of running like a wide open freewheeling offense with, you know, high screen and roll with Wade Baldwin and like surround with shooters and actually run some off ball motion. But Vanderbilt doesn't do that. And that's incredibly frustrating to me.
All right, Matt, if we take SMU's loss at Temple off the table, next biggest headline from the weekend, in your opinion, is?
To me, it's the Providence win at Villanova because Villanova had won 22 straight Big East games and had won 32 straight home games. Providence has not lost a road game yet this season. Now it's got a couple of clunker home outcomes that it wasn't able to close out in Providence, but has not lost away from home on the road and is 4-1 against ranked teams. You know, when PC kind of stumbled over the past 2 weeks, you know, we discussed how they had certain preseason expectations, and for them to have lost a couple similar to Michigan State wasn't the end of the world. Maybe they're just coming back down to earth, you know, the Marquette loss and the Seton Hall loss. But then they were able to beat Butler earlier in the week, and now they've taken out Villanova on the road. To me, this is going to end up being one of the handful of really, really important road victories in college basketball by the time we get to Selection Sunday, just because I think Villanova will win that league still. And they still are technically ahead overall sure. in the Big East, and I still think that they will win the league. And so I don't think you'll have too many instances where a regular season conference champion from one of the, you know, the Power Six, so to speak, drops a home game. You know, and if it does, will it come against a team of Providence's caliber? How many of those will happen? So I think it's going to benefit PC in the end to help them get a really nice seed. And in that game, I mean, listen, Sam was on the money to do a piece on Ben Bentel a couple of weeks back on CBSSports.com.
Love Ben Bentel.
Yeah, man. Listen, he 31-13. He is terrific. Dunn, actually, it's so funny. Dunn, if you watch the game, Dunn had he was okay, and then you look like he had, you know, 14 assists, 4 steals. He did foul out, but even like he made a couple of plays late. To me, when I watch Dunn play, and it's how, like, I know he's just NBA ready right now. First of all, whenever he has the ball in his hands and he's commanding it, like, it's, I can't keep my eyes off him. I find when to watch Chris Dunn play, it's just, it's magnetic. I love it. But there is certainly, he puts teams on their heels a lot with his ability to penetrate. I still don't like how much he settle sometimes for a step back jumper. I think he's got to maybe fix a little bit of that in this game. But the point I'm making is it's not just him. Bentel is becoming, in a way, he's almost hurting Dunn's player of the year campaign. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would still have Dunn as a top 5 guy, But Bentel would have to be in like a top 20 right now. I think you'd have to put him there just because of how well he's played. There's no doubt about it. He's the most improved player in the country. And we've got a situation where Providence is 17-3, and it will be in the NCAA tournament. It would take an absolute collapse that I can't possibly see happening. And I'll be at Providence on Tuesday night. They get a very interesting home test against Xavier. That's just a really, really awesome Big East game. I don't know if necessarily the winner or the loser gains or loses too much overall because their resumes are so strong, but it's going to be awesome to see those two teams go head-to-head. And if Providence does win, they'll have achieved something that's pretty remarkable, and maybe only Villanova will be able to match in that they'll have beaten the other three best teams in the league. And I think we can still call Butler number four. I know they're kind of wavering, but I would still call Butler four. So they would have beaten Butler, then Nova, then Xavier if they can pull it off.
You know, Providence right now is 37th at KenPom. That's the biggest discrepancy between me and my top 25 and one and like KenPom.
And they were, by the way, sorry to cut you off, GP. I checked before the game, they were 50th.
Right.
So they got a 13-point jump by beating Villanova. So they were way, way lower even before that.
When I update the top 25 and one in the morning, I will have them 8th. They've got a top 10 resume. I mean, at least the way I look at resumes, they've got five. Mm-hmm. They've got five top 50 KenPom wins. They got a win over Villanova. They got two over Butler. They've got a win over Arizona, and they've got a win over Creighton, and that's a road win. They've got the one stupid home loss to Marquette by a point. But like when you start stacking, resumes next to each other, and look like Providence got a top 10 resume right now. Like that's a good basketball team with a lot of quality wins, and. Now they get Xavier at home, in a game that I would assume they'll be favored in. I mean, it's close to a pick'em point, but like the job Ed's doing with this team, like Ben Bentham is awesome, but like he ain't supposed to be. You know, like this wasn't supposed to be the way it is, and it seems like Ed's been able to over time at Providence. He's always got one of these guys that just kind of. Wasn't a heralded recruit, and then he's just like, whoa, here's another dude scoring 17 points per game. Like, it seems like he's always got one of these on his team, you know?
Yeah, Bryce Cotton, LaDonte Hinton.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I can't say enough about the job he's done there. With Villanova, it's kind of funny. We talked on Friday about a lot of stuff, but two of the main things we talked about is Villanova's amazing 22-game Big East winning streak and the incredible job Sean Miller's doing at Arizona. And then I spend part of my Friday column on both of those things. And then Arizona goes out and loses to Cal, and Villanova goes out and loses to Providence.
The Cal thing, I mean, we can kind of transition here because I think two other ones we should talk about. One, we can spend a quick – we don't have to spend too much time on it. Cal absolutely had to have that because, to me, Cal – I haven't fielded, but I would say Cal's a borderline tournament team with the win now. They really needed that. They are 1-6 away from home, and so now they've got a couple of road games upcoming, Utah and Colorado. So Cal, to me, has still got plenty of work to do, but good on them for getting it. And then obviously Michigan State beating Maryland, that was the big primetime game. Those were actually – it was Michigan State, Maryland, and then Cal, Arizona on Saturday night were the two only real truly relevant games in the sport, and obviously that was just, Michigan State hasn't had a four-game losing streak since 2007. Matt Costello, that was just an awesome scene.
Yeah, like, no, right? Like, he was like, him picking up Izzo, and like, that was, listen, I'm not the guy that tries to tell you college basketball is the greatest sport in the world. Like, I think the NFL's better. I think college football's probably better. I think the NBA's probably better. But like, you don't get that. You're not getting that in college football. In the NBA, like that scene, that moment, that was a great college basketball moment.
I would laugh really hard if A'shaun Robinson would have picked up and spun Nick Saban though in the championship game.
That would have been actually pretty incredible. Saban would have cut him 2 minutes later. but no, listen, Michigan State needed that. And it's one of those things where like. I don't know. Maryland isn't going to be hurt too much by the loss. I don't think overall. But you just got to get off the schneid there. And that was huge for MSU. I think that the Spartans are still going to be a team that can contend for a pretty good seed down the road. But the Big Ten's super interesting, man. I mean, do you guys want to address, like, I don't think we spent much time on this on the podcast. And if we have, I'm just blanking on it. And I know Sam's ready to talk about it, but Indiana is the only other undefeated team right there with Iowa. I mean, yeah, those two teams, like...
No. Okay, yeah. So Iowa and Indiana are both 7-0 and in the league. Now, those are very different 7-0s.
Yeah,
very. Sure.
Very different 7-0s. I mean, it looks the same in the standings. Very different 7-0s. Iowa 7-0 features two wins over Michigan State, two wins over Purdue, and a win over Michigan. Okay, so that's five wins right there. I believe what I'm about to say is true. I'll double check myself. Because Indiana's 7-0 is a win over Rutgers, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Ohio State, Minnesota, Illinois, Northwestern. Okay, here's
basically the bottom half of the league.
Here's the point I was going to make. Iowa 7-0 and Indiana 7-0. Iowa has five wins in their 7-0, in its 7-0, better than any of Indiana's wins in its 7-0. They've got two Michigan States, two Purdue's, and a Michigan. Those five wins are better than any Big Ten win that Indiana has. So I will. So it seems clear, and this isn't a knock because, as I've written before, when you're 5-3 and coming off a 20-point loss to Duke after losing to Wake Forest and to a Mountain West school that subsequently fired its coach midseason, however you get to 17-3 from 5-3 is amazing. But – like, it ain't like they've gone out and knocked out Maryland and knocked out Michigan State and knocked out Purdue and knocked out Iowa yet. Their schedule's coming. You know, again, I'd celebrate it if I were Tom. And he undeniably has them playing better, regardless of the victims on the schedule. But that 7-0 is not the same as Iowa 7-0, if that makes sense.
No, it's not remotely close, actually. Right. But like you said, Indiana is clearly playing better, especially on the defensive end.
Yeah.
I mean, they are the number one team in the Big Ten right now by defensive efficiency, and that's by over 3 points per 100 possessions over Maryland. So, and then they're 7 points better than Iowa in third place. Like, this Indiana team, compared to where they were early in the season defensively, whenever they gave up like a point and a half per possession against Duke, right, in that game at Cameron Indoor, like, this, it's night and day where Indiana is. And part of that, I mean, and this is somewhat unfair to James Blackmon, but part of that is, you know, getting a little bit of an infusion of length and athleticism at the two guard spot with Oji Anunoby, Juwan Morgan. Like they have wings that they can play now that are just undeniably more athletic and better defenders than Blackmon is.
Iowa fans hate you though now.
Is it because I've had a couple of people ask me this question, and I mean, listen, I know what the numbers say. It's still a weird thing to suggest, but like, are they better without James Blackmon? They've lost maybe an NBA player and gotten better. Like, is that what's happened? I mean, are they? I mean, I know they've been winning more without James, but are they actually better without him?
I will say that there's a very thin like line there between going from like causation to correlation. You know what I mean? Like, you know, maybe that lineup, they have enough offense in the lineup as it is, and getting that defense from Juwan Morgan and Anunoby is just better. But it's hard for me to say that a team is better without James Blackmon in college basketball. You know what I mean? It's a very thin line, I think, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm not going to pretend to know because I'm not around that team daily. You know what I mean? Like, I can't really, you know, pretend to say that I know what the players are thinking, what their thought processes are out on the floor. It's just a very difficult line to kind of thread. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I would say this, like, I don't really know what Tom said in the press conferences when asked about it, but when I've talked to him, he's not, and I'm saying, like, I'm just being honest. He's not even like privately off the record saying, man, we got a lot better when James Blackmon left. Like he does not think they're better without James Blackmon. In fact, last time I talked to him, he was like, you know, losing James really hurts us. It messes up our spacing. And, you know, he does not see, he's very happy with how the team's playing and winning. But I can just tell you again, like, on the record, off the record, he doesn't view losing James Blackmon as a positive for his basketball team.
Right. Now, you know, I don't think any coach really would, although having said that, I did talk to a coach earlier this year who lost his best player from last year and said that there was a little bit of addition by subtraction.
I've heard that from coaches. Yeah.
Yeah. But typically whenever you lose a guy like James Blackmon, you're not going to have the coach come out and say, yeah, like we're better without this guy because we get the infusion of athleticism. But to a certain extent, maybe having him around to be off the bench and, you know, provide some like microwave scoring would be terrific. But, you know, maybe the minute distribution clears up a little bit better with black men on the sideline. It's just, like I said, it's such a hard needle to kind of thread. And I mean, not being around the team, it's impossible to really say.
You know, with we go back to the Big Ten with Iowa, you know, that's why their ranking's very different than Indiana's right now. I mean, Iowa's 16-3, Indiana 17-3, but I will have tomorrow morning Iowa ranked third in the country, and I'll have Indiana ranked 19th in the country. And I'll also have Texas A&M in the top five. In other words, my two of my top five teams will be Iowa and Texas A&M. Could you have ever imagined that? And it's not like I'm out there. Like, that's probably I think that's where they belong by definition. I'm the one that does the rankings. Like, you look at resumes, like Iowa and Texas A&M are legitimate top five teams right now.
Crazy. And man, A&M, yeah, 17-2 A&M. Okay, we spent some time on him on the previous podcast when I made Mark Turgeon disappear. And listen, they're 7-0 in the SEC. There's nothing you can't really say anything bad about what this team has done, because the losses, neutral against Syracuse, who isn't terrible,
at Arizona State,
not awful. I think you could probably get a little bit of an argument, but undeniably, A&M a top five team. Iowa at three is for sure. I still think it's going to take some people a while to come around on fully being in on Iowa. I would say, listen, it's a legit team, and people need to start looking at Iowa as a team that, if it basically keeps up the way it's been playing, and that's even with a loss or two, like, Iowa's going to be a number one seed. Like, yeah, it's going to have to really lose some games that it shouldn't lose. And maybe that happens. So far
it hasn't really happened. I mean, right. Okay, like, they've got three losses, but none outside the top 50 at KenPom. The worst loss on paper is an 82-77 loss to Dayton. Dayton's good.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
No.
Other neutral court loss, 68-62 to Notre Dame. And the other loss is at Iowa State in a game, frankly, that they blew. You know, like, they had that game. Like,
no.
Should have won the game. Like, a whole bunch of stupid stuff had to happen for them not to win that game. So nobody's run them off the court. They haven't lost a home or neutral site game since November 27th. So we're talking, like, basically in 2 months. And the only loss since November 27th is a loss at Hilton, where they should have won. And meantime, it ain't like they're just, like, you know, beating up on a bunch of nobodies. Like, they've got two wins over Michigan State, home and away. Two wins over Purdue, home and away. They've got a double-digit win over Michigan at home. And that's a Michigan team that beat Maryland. So, maybe they don't blow you away in terms of individual talent. Maybe they don't blow you away in terms of you're not used to seeing Fran McCaffrey everywhere. But, like, this is a very good college basketball team, and the resume is the resume. Like, not everybody agrees with, ranking teams is subjective, obviously. I tend to look at resumes, wake up every day and look at bodies of work, and, like, that body of work is it's a top three body of work.
So why do the Iowa fans hate Sam?
Do they hate you, Sam? I don't know what happened.
It's because I said that Tom Crean should be coach of the year in the Big Ten. Because Tom Crean has improved his team more throughout the course of the season than I think Fran McCaffrey has.
Well, here's what I would say. Fran had an unranked team in the preseason, and now he's got.
Yeah, but that doesn't really bother me necessarily. Like, the idea of rankings in the preseason, it's clear that Indiana was a little bit overrated in the preseason, though.
Compared
to where they were.
What if somebody's counterargument to your argument was a very simple: one guy had a preseason top 10 team, took it clear out of the rankings. Another guy had an unranked team, he's taking it into the top five. Get out of my face, Fran McCaffrey's coach of the year.
No, I mean, you. By the way, if you voted Fran McCaffrey, I wouldn't be like,
right,
oh yeah, like, you're wrong. No, like, it's a decision where I think there are two very viable candidates.
No, you can get a reasonable vote for Tom. Like, that wouldn't be crazy. But I guess I would just rely on Iowa was supposed to just be another team. Instead, they're like a one seed basically right now. And perfect in their league. If you got to give a Big Ten Coach of the Year award right now, I'd give it.
Sure, and there's the whole idea that Iowa lost to Augustana in the preseason, right? I am just totally wrong.
Yeah, how about that? You say Fran hasn't taken it. Fran took his team from losing to a D2 school to they can't lose to anybody. Wow. Where are you at on this, Norlander?
I'm with Fran decidedly at this point.
Yeah.
And I say that with complete admission that I declare that Indiana didn't have a chance at getting its defense turned around to this degree. And it totally has.
Yeah.
I'm continually blown away by it, but I'm still very much, let's wait and see. I feel like there's a shoe that might drop with the Hoosiers, who are going to make the tournament with room to spare. But you tell me over under 3.5 Indiana standing in the Big Ten regular season when we get to the end of the year, I still might take under, meaning fourth or worse.
Okay, let me.
No, I would take over, or like third or better, because their schedule doesn't really get super crazy.
I would take
They do have to face Iowa twice. They have to face Maryland once. They have to face Michigan State once, and they get Purdue once. Like, you still have Wisconsin, Minnesota, Penn State, Illinois, Nebraska.
Yeah.
And that's probably 12 wins right there.
Yeah.
So you would think that, you know, maybe they steal one or two of those games against the stronger opposition.
I would take top three. If you told me Indiana top three, yes or no, finishing the Big Ten, I would say yes right now.
And honestly, I don't know that Indiana, as far as like a talent level, is a top three team in the Big Ten.
Right.
Either. Like, it just comes down to schedule for me. Like, you could tell me that you would rather have Iowa, Michigan State, and Maryland, and I'd be like, you're not wrong.
Right.
Michigan's only two games behind and it's going to get Levert back at some point here. So if it can keep going, you know,
One last thing about the top 25 and one, I do not have Kentucky in it, and Kentucky fans are incredibly offended by this development. They alternate between telling me my rankings do not matter while also telling me how furious they are about them. My own approach to life is to never get mad about stuff that I don't think matters, but like, what, I'm not going to tell other people how to live their lives. I would say this: there's actually a case to be made for Kentucky. Like, you can reasonably rank Kentucky. They might be one of the top 26 teams in America. If they're ranked tomorrow, and I'm sure they will be in the AP poll and the coaches poll, I won't spend the Politex column attacking people that voted for Kentucky. I would say this, though. They have four losses outside of the top 50 at KenPom. Four. And they only have three wins inside. Now, again, there is no like hard rules about any of this stuff, and it's all subjective, but I can tell you this as a matter of fact. Of the 26 teams I have ranked, none of them have more losses outside of the top 50 than they do wins inside of the top 50. None of them. None of them. And Kentucky does. And so, you know, Kentucky fans like are focusing on, we beat Louisville, we beat Duke, how could we not be ranked? Okay, but like, there's another, like, the losses matter too. And you have four outside the top 50. Again, you can reasonably rank them. But if I had Kentucky in the top 25 and one, I guess this is my point, they would be the only team in the top 25 and one that has more losses outside of KenPom's top 50 than wins inside of KenPom's top 50. They've got three top 50 wins and four sub 50 losses. So for all the Kentucky fans asking for an explanation, there is your explanation. Let's look ahead a little bit. Got two good games Monday night. Duke at Miami, Kansas at Iowa State. Let's start with Duke at Miami. They won at NC State over the weekend, so they snapped their three-game losing streak, avoided a four-game losing streak for the first time since 2007. But what does that mean, and does it suggest that they can go down and win at Miami? Because I don't think they can go down and win at Miami.
Matt, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was actually ceding the floor to you, Sam.
I didn't want to open my mouth on it.
Listen, Duke's going to be in just a super weird spot here if it doesn't win. Miami is, 15-3? Does Duke have three? Yeah, because it dropped three in a row. So Duke has got three losses already in the league.
Yeah, Duke's 15-5 overall, 4-3 in the league. The losses are to Kentucky, Utah, out of conference, Clemson, Notre Dame, Syracuse, inside the league.
Right. Problematic here. And what's going to happen is, I know that Emile Jefferson is still not back. And if and when he gets back, and he's going to get back, when that happens, and if Duke is able to play strongly, you know, the fans are going to think that the committee should really evaluate Duke more on when he was there than when he was not. There gets to be a certain point where you've missed enough games that I'm sorry that you're going to be judged and lose seed spots accordingly. So even when you didn't have your star player, if he's gone for a serious amount of time, if Duke loses here, Do you think Duke's going to be ranked, GP? Where do you have him in your poll right now?
I have Duke at 23rd. And
they're going to stay ranked.
Well, here's what I'll tell you.
They might not be ranked.
No, they might not be, but here's what I would tell you. Holding them to the same standard that I held Kentucky, right? Kentucky's got 4 losses outside of the top 50, 3 wins inside the top 50. They got more losses outside the top 50 than they do wins inside the top 50. Now, again, I understand that, you know, where these games were played matters, who was playing in them matters. These aren't hard and fast rules, but it is at least one measuring device, right? Okay, so for Duke, you apply the same standard to them. They have 2 losses outside of the top 50, Utah in OT and at Clemson by 5 points. So Kentucky has 4 outside of the top 50. Duke only has 2 outside of the top 50. And then Duke has a VCU win. VCU's 30th at KenPom. A Georgetown win. Georgetown's 50th at KenPom. And I believe in an Indiana win. Indiana's 20th at KenPom. So Duke has 3 wins inside the top 50 and 2 losses outside of the top 50, whereas Kentucky has 3 inside wins and 4 losses outside. So, like, again, this isn't hard and fast, but, you know, Duke has better losses or not as many bad losses, and they've got comparable wins. I mean, I think Kentucky's clearly got better wins, including a win over Duke. But Kentucky's got 4 losses outside of the top 50, including one to Auburn. And Auburn stinks. So, like, listen, you could rank Kentucky and Duke. You could probably not rank either. But I think Duke at this moment has a better resume than Kentucky.
All right, real quick here. So if Miami wins, and I'll pick Miami right here on the podcast. I think Miami will win. That'll probably be their moment of arrival now that college basketball is more on everyone's radar because it's, you know, we got a little layup here for the Super Bowl and all that stuff. So people give a little more love to Miami. If Sam wants to chime in on that game, he can. But real quick from me on the other game, Kansas, Iowa State. Iowa State, if it wins here, and I think I don't know who's going to win. I'm really torn on this. But if it does beat Kansas, what you'll have is Kansas's Big 12 streak really coming into jeopardy. Because of the fact that Oklahoma, first of all, there's a logjam atop the league right now.
Right now, there's four schools that are 5-2.
5-2. Oklahoma, West Virginia, Kansas, and Baylor. Mm-hmm. But Oklahoma's going to be in the driver's seat because Oklahoma is tied with everyone else, and it's already gotten its road game against Kansas out of the way, its road game against Iowa State out of the way, and its road game against Baylor out of the way. Yeah. It did go 1-2 in those games, but it's the only school that has its 3 toughest road games in the league, and if you want to throw West Virginia in there, I understand, but you get what I'm saying. Like, if Kansas does lose, Oklahoma will have a real, real good shot at taking the league crown.
Based on what, like, that I think Oklahoma is, like, I don't know if they're the best team in the country. I think North Carolina might be the best team in the country. Like, if you told me to take $100,000 and bet it on somebody to win the tournament, I might put it on Carolina. But, like, as I've talked about already, I think Oklahoma has the best resume. And given that, combined with the schedule, like exactly what you mentioned, Orlando, they've already got their road games at Kansas and Iowa State behind them. I would bet, like if you told me I had to take $100,000 and pick a winner, Big 12, at this point, as weird as this sounds, I would put my money on Oklahoma to win the Big 12 this year.
Sam?
I mean, would you take the – I would guess that Kansas and Oklahoma probably split it at this point. I know
also,
that
– yeah.
Yeah, like that.
The most likely outcome is a tie. Yeah.
Well, think about this. Okay, so Kansas is going to be an underdog tomorrow night at Hilton. Okay.
Sure.
So let's say they lose that. Then they got 3 losses.
The Oklahoma State loss is killing Kansas.
You can't lose those. Like, there's a couple of you got to basically to win the Big 12. I think this is what we're going to find out. You got to win your home games, and you cannot lose on the road to Oklahoma State or TCU.
Yep.
That's the way you do it. And Kansas already has one of those losses. And so here's my point. Kansas underdog tomorrow night. If they lose at Hilton, which is if by definition you're an underdog, you're kind of supposed to. That's 3 league losses, and then they still got to go to Oklahoma. So if they can't win at Oklahoma, then that's 4. I mean, if they don't win at Hilton, they probably need to win at Oklahoma, or they're in trouble.
It's fascinating. Love this stuff.
Yeah, like if they don't win at Hilton, they're probably going to have to win at Oklahoma. I bet you this. I bet you Kansas cannot win the Big 12 without winning at least at Hilton or at Oklahoma.
I think
Oklahoma.
That's fair.
Yeah,
I think that's fair.
Right. So, like, can you like that's that's a hell of a hard thing to do, though.
It's a hell of a hard thing to do. I don't think they're going to win tomorrow night. I think Iowa State's going to take it, but we'll see how Iowa State defends.
And what a nice story that's turned into. Like, I wrote about this last week. Like, after the Texas game, Steve Prohm actually took for people who didn't read the column, he took Facebook and Twitter off of his phone so that he wouldn't see it anymore because, like, he acknowledged it was getting to him. And, like, you know, he's, you know, it's a double-edged sword, like the situation he walked into. On one hand, hey, here's a $1 million-a-year raise and you get a top 10 team. Like, well, my God, that's unbelievable. But you also get the expectations of your top 10 team. Whereas, you know, Bobby Hurley takes a new job. Ben Howland takes a new job. You know, you're not expected to come. Avery Johnson takes a new job. You're not expected to come. Like, you just sort of, you get a few years just to get comfortable. People don't expect anything from you from day one, except for maybe, you know, on the recruiting trail. Well, Steve gets that Iowa State job, and you better win now or else. And it got ugly. And, you know, he said, listen, I care so much about this place. And it was like the quotes were pretty refreshing, candid. He said, I care. And I don't want to feel like I'm letting people down. I don't want to disappoint people. I don't want people to think I'm not worthy of this job. And so he had to, like, detach from social media. Like, we've all been there. Probably maybe not to that extreme, but, like, where you just feel like I need to not look at this stuff right now.
Sam's almost there with Iowa right, fans right now.
Right. I mean, so, like, it really can't. I heard Howard Stern talk about this one time. He said he doesn't spend much time on Twitter because, like, and like Howard Stern's immensely popular. He is incredibly successful, like maybe the most successful, probably the most successful radio host in the history of radio. And, like, he was like, and I pop on Twitter and people just, like, are just, like, saying such mean things about me. And it's like, it just messes with your mood. And so, like, if even somebody who's undeniably successful and well-liked, you know, is still getting blasted by strangers on Twitter to the point where he's like, man, this is kind of weird. Like, this is messing with my mind and mood. Imagine what it's like when you, like, take a top 10 team and lose, you know, 3 or 4 games to Oklahoma, Baylor, Texas. So Steve was really going through it. And then he bounces back, wins at Kansas State, beats Oklahoma, then goes wins at TCU. And now if he can get this one tomorrow night against Kansas, like, he's completely flipped the script. And I don't get involved in, like, rooting for teams too much unless I happen to have money on them or something. But, like, I do root for, like, stories, and I do root for, like, good things to happen for good people type of stuff. And, you know, I just sort of try to put myself in other people's shoes sometimes and, like, how I'd be feeling if I were Steve Prohm and underachieving by definition at Iowa State, following the, you know, Fred Hoiberg and still living in that unbelievably huge shadow. So, like, I was like, you know, I don't want to tell you I was rooting for him to beat Oklahoma, but, like, I like the byproduct of that. Like, I like that I had a coach text me Monday night. Was that last Monday night? How about this? A coach completely, like, I don't even know if he knows Steve, right? And he texted me after that game was over. Actually, he texted me after I wrote my column the next day. And he said, hey, I just read the column. He said, I'm really happy for Steve. He said, did you notice at the end of that game? He said, even after they're winning and, like, people are storming the court, he's like, he didn't even look happy. He just looked relieved. Like, thank God I did not lose this game. And, like, that's a hell of a way to live, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, you kind of covered it all, GP, there. I got to say.
I turned back into old Gary on the podcast.
Where no, it's fine.
Where
it's,
I talk, no, that was
hey, you know what? You're allowed to because it's your damn birthday.
It is my birthday.
Happy birthday acknowledgement.
It is my
GP.
Birthday.
How's it feel now that you're in your fifth decade.
Let the record show I'm 39 years old. I don't know why Goodman thinks that's funny. Like, and I have to choose. So here's what happens. Like, Goodman thinks it's funny to pretend everybody's older than they are for some reason.
Legitimately texted probably 25 people to tell you that. Yeah.
Oh, I know. Like, Frank Martin is tweeting about me being 51 years old. Like,
so ridiculous.
It is really, really ridiculous. You know? Like,
maybe you need to take Twitter off your phone.
Well, like, okay, so you have to decide very early on. Are you going to like, play along, and, like, and by play along, I mean say, I'm not 51, like, to everybody who says it, like, then it's like, then you're arguing people like you're Sam, or,
yeah, don't do that,
or,
do not do that,
or you just ignore it, at which point, like, here's the problem, I do look older than 39, you know, I have gray hair and a bald spot,
absolutely.
I've lived a hard life, you know, so I do look older than 39, so I don't know if I look 51, but I don't know that that's the most unbelievable thing in the world. And yet, I don't want people thinking I'm 51 years old. You know, I'm 39 years old. I'm 39 years old. I'm still in my 30s for another year. But it's, yes, it's my birthday. I celebrated by doing sideline duty for East Carolina, Memphis.
And East Carolina, Yo, whoa. The Pirates.
The Pirates, man. The
Pirates beat Memphis.
Pirates came into FedEx Forum and got work done. Never mind that they were winless in the conference and winless on the road and without their second leading scorer. They came in and won at FedEx Forum. Oh man, that's a killer. That's a killer. That's one.
Pastner's making it through the week, right?
Yeah, like this isn't the type of he ain't the type of guy that would get fired mid-year. That's not the way this would go
it's
on.
It's gonna cost millions upon millions to get him out.
The issue, and yeah, I mean,
I don't like it when people get fired. So good.
Here's the problem. Like Memphis fans are weird when it comes to Josh in this way. Undeniably, he's not getting the job done now. Like nobody could intelligently or unintelligently argue otherwise. Like the recruiting has slipped. Last year was bad. This year, I mean, they just lost to East Carolina at home. Like, what are we
Pirates?
To the Pirates. What are we talking about, right? So, like, nobody could argue he's doing a good job now or that he's getting the job done now. But like Memphis fans tend to think he never got the job done. Like he's always been bad. And I would submit like his first 5 years, he went to 4 NCAA tournaments in his first 5 years as a head coach. Like, was consistently ranked in the top 25. Like, I grew up in the area. When I was a kid, if Memphis was ranked in the top 25, that was like a big deal. I was like, whoa, the Tigers are ranked 23rd. Can you believe it? And like, John Calipari skewed all that. So, like, now it was a big deal if you're not in the top 25. Like, that means you're terrible. But, like, I don't know. I think the Memphis coach going to 4 tournaments in 5 years is, like, pretty good, really good for the Memphis coach. So, where I get sideways with Memphis fans sometimes is, like, don't tell me he's been a disaster from the beginning. His first 5 years were good by normal Memphis standards. But now it's really bad. And, you know, it's hard to envision it getting better, if only because the fans don't believe anymore. Like, there might have been 5,000 people at that game today.
Oh, boy.
I mean, this is a place that used to sell 17,000 season tickets. They have 18,000 for anybody. Like, you could play East Carolina on a Sunday afternoon, and there'd be 18,000 people there. And, you know, today there was maybe – there's been games this year where there's only 3,000 people there. And the fans just fundamentally don't believe. You know, when you get to that point as a politician where your constituents don't believe in you anymore, like it's hard to lead. Same way in coaching, particularly college coaching. When your fans don't believe you're the guy for the job anymore, it's hard to convince them otherwise. And beyond that, you know, if you're not good this year and you're losing Ricky Tarrant and you're losing Shaq Goodwin and you're losing Trayshon Burrell, you're probably losing 3 of your best 4 or 5 players, and they've signed one top 100 kid to come in, a point guard out of Chicago. So, like, how are they going to be better next year, right? The problem, of course, is he's got a $10 million buyout, like $10 million. That's the buyout. I mean, it's incredible.
Check that agent. I mean, what the heck is that, $10 million?
I mean, Memphis was silly. You know, it happened ridiculous. When – I mean, it's just a daunt. Like, listen, I'm happy for Josh. Get paper, man. But, like, I mean, the idea that the athletic director at Memphis would sign off on a $2.65 million contract, that's an automatic rollover. Basically, the buyout was going to be $10 million forever. Like, you know, that's not quite true, but like it is right now, $10 million buyout. Like, what do you like? Why would you sign that? Like, why? You know, like, and it was because Josh got offered the USC job, and they felt like they needed to secure their hot and young coach. But like, you know, what a more savvy athletic director would have probably done would have said, you know what? If you want to leave your top 10 recruiting class to go coach at USC, knock yourself out. You know, like dare him to take the job. You know, that's what UCLA did for years. You know, Ben Hallen never made like what he probably should have made at UCLA. And you want to know why? You know what UCLA – now they're paying Offord in a way that they never paid Ben. But you know what UCLA's administration did, which sucked for Ben, but like I sort of get it from their perspective? Here's what they'd say. We realize that Nebraska is offering you more money than we're paying you to coach at UCLA. If you would like to leave UCLA to go coach Nebraska, you should do that. And it's like, well, I'm not leaving UCLA to go coach in Nebraska, or I'm not leaving Westwood to go live in Nebraska. Like, so like, sure. And you can sort of like that. That's I don't understand. And now we're getting way off topic, but I do find this interesting.
It's your birthday.
You get this moment.
I do find this interesting. Why do athletic directors feel compelled to sign coaches to these long-term contracts? Why do you have to do it? You know what they say for recruiting, right? Well, if you can't show a kid you're going to be there at least for the next 4 years, then, you know, you're not going to be able to tell him you're going to be his coach. Well, you can't tell him that anyway. Like, kids should be, or at least their parents or AAU coaches, should be savvy enough to understand, like, just because somebody has a 5-year contract doesn't mean they're going to coach there for 5 years. So like once you realize the 5-year contract doesn't actually guarantee anything, it just guarantees you're going to get paid. It doesn't guarantee you're going to be the coach. Why do athletic directors sign these coaches to 5-year contracts, 6-year contracts, 7-year contracts? Why would you do that?
Well, I would say that in a lot of cases, you're not talking about a situation like UCLA. You're talking about a situation like Memphis.
Well, like I'm talking about
realistically, it's relatively easy to poach someone.
Well, here's what I would say. Well, okay. But how's it, any time a Memphis coach wants to leave Memphis to go somewhere else, he can do it. Like here's what I would argue. The long-term contract never really benefits the school. It benefits the coach because it gives him financial security, but it will never keep a coach from leaving you. But what it can do is keep you from getting rid of the coach if he's bad. Like because the coach, like the buyout's always going to be 250, you know, 100,000.
Well, here's what my argument would be to you.
Uh-huh.
If Wichita State didn't make such a large commitment to Greg Marshall this year,
right?
Would he be at Wichita State still?
Well, like
no, they absolutely. They came in hot and heavy and hard, super hard, last minute, and barely got him.
So, like, if you think that Greg Marshall is your guy, that's what you have to do. You have to back up the truck to make sure that you keep your guy.
Okay.
In Memphis, the scenario.
Okay. Can we
argue? More to GP's point here, right. I'm telling you, if Wichita State makes the Final Four this year,
right,
and someone comes in, he's going to be gone.
How about this?
I'm not saying it's going to happen, but right. I'm saying, and then was it worth it for Wichita State? Because if the Shockers go on another run and they've got, you know, they're sneakily
sure it was because
dominating,
they don't have to pay a buyout.
Well, here's Missouri Valley.
No, here's what I'm telling you. All right. They stepped up and they committed more than $3 million a year to Greg. Long-term contract, whatever. All right. And so what does that do? It keeps Greg from taking the Alabama job. If the Indiana job opens for whatever reason and they want Greg Marshall, guess where Greg Marshall's coaching next year?
Sure, but my point is, though, that long-term deal didn't necessarily hinder Wichita in that scenario.
Well, okay.
It kept their guy.
No. But listen, it's never going to bother you or hurt you as long as your guy's awesome consistently. I'm talking about in this hypothetical.
In the Pastner scenario, it doesn't really work.
Well, my argument is it can't really help the school. Because if the coach wants to leave because he's so awesome and gets another opportunity, he's going to leave. But the alternative to him being awesome is him being crappy. And if he's crappy, you are stuck with him. So like with Greg Marshall, as long as Greg Marshall continues to be awesome, then the contract will never hurt Wichita State. But the contract also will not keep Greg Marshall from leaving for an Indiana job. And if Greg Marshall, for whatever reason, and I don't think this would happen, but like it just went straight into the gutter. Wichita State stuck with a coach who just ran its program straight in the gutter.
It's like a big contract in baseball. Like you see that, you know, Ryan Howard gets this 5-year, $125 million extension when he still has 2 years left on his contract, which everyone knew when they signed it was going to go south, and it ends up going south. You can't necessarily pinpoint the worst case scenario and make it stand for the whole in that way. Like the Miguel Cabrera contract, you know that that's going to go south in the last 3 years of it for the Tigers. But if the Tigers can wring out enough value in the first, I don't know, like 6 years of that deal, it's the same. Like it works.
I don't think it's
like
the same
it works
thing,
for them.
No, because I think this is apples and oranges. Because again, if Miguel Cabrera is awesome, like. He can't leave.
Baseball contracts are just flat out insane, by the way.
Yeah,
so,
I know. But like,
this is
like
a totally different universe.
But my point, like with Cabrera, okay.
He can't flat out leave, no.
He can't leave you. Whereas if Greg Marshall's awesome, he can leave you. That's my point with college basketball coaches. You sign them to long-term deals because you think it locks them up. But it doesn't really lock them up. It only locks you to them if they're crappy. It doesn't lock them to you under any circumstances.
So it's more – okay. So, again, I'm going to actually give the baseball scenario because I can actually think of another example. So it's like giving an opt-out. So, like, the Mets just gave Yoenis Cespedes an opt-out,
yes,
right?
Yes,
so it's like that where if they can wring enough value out of him in that first year, it's fully worth it. Like, say you give him $30 million in the first year and then have, like, $22.5 million for each of the next 2 years, and he gets hurt and he blows his ACL this year in September. Or something like that, after he gives you 7 wins worth of value, I mean, it kind of ends up being fine for the organization, I guess I would say, because you get that value up front as opposed to getting it later.
But here, we are so far off topic.
We are so far off right now.
Yeah,
so far off. Watch the X-Files, man.
Please, just turn off the podcast at this point if you guys are bored by this conversation.
No, I'm actually, it's a very fascinating conversation.
The Cespedes thing is, first off, it is exactly why the Mets didn't want to go 5 years with him, like, because they think it's going to tell off. They could only get it done with 3. If they were willing to let him opt out. In other words, sure, you can opt out after 1 if you want to. We just want you they needed that bat in the lineup for this coming up season. And then if he wants to opt out and go try to get a 5-year deal, they're fine with it. But, like, still, again, I let me wrap this back around and then we'll move on. In college coaching, and I'm strictly talking about college coaching, if you sign a man, forget Greg Marshall, forget Josh Pastner, let's just in general, if you were at a school and you sign a man to a 5-year deal worth, let's just say, $15 million.
Sure.
There is a scenario under which he's awesome and, like, it doesn't hurt you. There is no scenario where it helps you. I don't know how it helps you, because if that guy is awesome and so awesome that a better job comes after him, your contract will not prevent him from leaving. If he wants to go, he'll go. Steve Alford left after agreeing to a brand new contract in New Mexico.
Was it a 10-year deal? Something.
Sometimes you have to offer the money to keep your guy.
But no, I agree. Offer the money. You don't have to offer the years. That's what I'm saying. Because here, bottom line in college coaching, guys keep the jobs they have until they get a job offer they view as better, and then they take that job, and their contract never prevents them from doing it. Do you even know what kind of contract? And I'm not trying to, like, put you on the spot. It's a rhetorical question. Like, nobody knows what kind of contract John Calipari had at Memphis. He had just signed a brand new 5-year contract the year before, like, before the season started. It doesn't matter. Kentucky wants you, you go. So my point is this: the long term contract, it will lock up your coach for the time being. If he wins and continues to win at the level he's winning at right now, then you're fine. But it won't prevent him from leaving. If somebody else wants him and he wants to go, he can go. That contract will not lock him in. So it will not tie him to you. But what it does do is tie you to him in a way where if it goes the wrong way, you are really stuck in a bad spot. It happened to Georgia Tech with Paul Hewitt. It's happened to Memphis now with Josh Pastner. It happened to Oklahoma State right now with Travis Ford. Like, think about all the Georgia Tech with Brian Gregory. Dave Rice, that's one of the reasons he kept his job after last season, was the contract. These long-term contracts tie school. I'll bottom line it like this. The long-term contracts in college coaching way more often, put the schools in terrible situations than they do put the schools in great situations. That's all.
Sure, I would say long-term, there's significant downside, and maybe there should be fewer years attached to college coaches' contracts, but I don't think it's, like, a significant issue either if you're trying to keep a coach that you believe is truly the guy for your program. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a significant problem right now at Oklahoma State and Memphis, and you could argue...
Yeah, but you know, like, there are significant... there are going to be downsides to contracts, and there are going to be positive things to contracts. You know what I mean? Like Tony Bennett right now at Virginia is an example of...
Pretty sure
he has a very long-term contract.
Okay, and guess what? If he wants to leave, he'll leave. The contract will not tie him to Virginia. If the Wisconsin job comes,
sure,
to
it's
him,
not going
to
tie him to Virginia.
So then, what's the point of the long-term contract from the school's perspective?
To keep him from going.
But it doesn't keep him. It doesn't keep him.
It's an immediate benefit, though. It's not like say a school 2 years ago offered Tony Bennett somewhere, like, amazing, the job somewhere else. It's an immediate benefit to keep your guy from staying. Yeah, I agree with you that collegiate contracts should be a little bit shorter. But on the whole, the immediate benefit is actually really strong because you keep the guy in place.
What is
that you think is the guy for your program?
You only keep him in place because he doesn't get a better deal somewhere else. You don't keep him in place because of the contract. Any coach in America can sign a 5-year deal tomorrow and leave.
It's the same as any other free agency situation, though.
But that's my thing. Why do we have to do 5 years? If I were an athletic director, that's what I would be asking myself.
Because the market makes it so. You know what I mean? Like, it's a market economic situation more than it is. I mean, you could collude with all of the other athletic directors and say, like,
we should not
offer these 5-year deals. But that's the way the market is now. They're offering these 5-year deals, and to outdo the other schools, you have to offer years.
No, I get that completely. And I guess my larger point, and really my only point, was, how did that become the market? Like, how did coaches trick and their agents trick athletic departments into thinking that has to be the market. They trick them by saying we have to have the security for recruiting, otherwise we can't recruit.
And by the way,
and I submit that that's not a real issue.
My one quick thing here is, like, and it's bad in college basketball, but in college football, in the offensive and defensive coordinator market, like, it's getting insane. Like, utterly and completely ridiculous, considering the inventory of games, the sizes of rosters, and just, like, guys in the SEC clearing $1 million a year that aren't even head coaches.
No, it's wild. Anyway, that was – I don't know if that was an interesting conversation, but it is –
No, it was really good, and I can't wait for, like, the Sunday night at the Final Four when we stoke this conversation again at a bar, and you guys are going until, like, 3 in the morning.
I'm going to do? I'm gonna ask – like, next few times I bump into associate ADs or – I'm going to, like – I'll pick their brains about it. Like, explain to me why you think – I know the answer. Sam's exactly right. This is what the market dictates, right? It's why people thought the Mets were going to have to go 5 years for Cespedes, because it appeared that that would be what the market would dictate, although it didn't. But, like, it's very much rooted in, well, that's, we have to go 5 years because everybody else goes 5 years. I mean, that is, Sam's exactly right there. I guess my point is, like, let's back up and go, okay, how did we get to this market? And how do we benefit as a athletic department from having coaches to 5 years? I know we have to do it because everybody else is doing it, but why do we as a why do we have to, as athletic departments, do 5 years? Like, how do we get tricked into this? And like I said, it's all based on I need a 4 or 5 year contract. What is happening? Are you killing your dog? Are you taking out dog, Sam? Here, like, Sam, are you taking
like
out? Are
4 minutes
taking,
ago, his Sam, dog was coming.
I think Sam's taking his frustration out of me on his dog. Do not, hey, don't you hurt,
so angry.
Don't you hurt little Penny because you're mad at me.
I honestly don't know what happened. Like, I have no idea what's going out there. I like podcast in like the corner of my room, and I can't see what she is doing by like the door of my apartment right now. So she might be going crazy at like the smallest fly, like on the mirror, or she might be like barking at herself in the mirror. I don't even.
Amazing podcast.
Anyway, I just remembered that we got into this conversation somehow just by somebody wishing me happy birthday.
Right.
Which is ridiculous. All right, let's go. Sam's got to go take care of his dog. I got to go to bed, I think. And Norlander's probably got to, feed a baby a bottle or something.
Got to watch some X-Files, man. Are you kidding me right now?
You know
now?
What? I never watched X-Files. I can't get – I love David Duchovny. I love the
– Californication?
I love Californication. I love
– Underrated disposable TV show. Absolutely.
Like, if you liked Entourage, what you really should have liked is Californication.
You know what? I would agree with that because I was not an Entourage fan. Right. But X-Files, yeah. No, it was kind of, child of the 90s. Absolutely love it. And
I'm actually watching it right now as well.
Okay, Sam. You watch X-Files and take care of your dog. Norlander, you watch X-Files and I'll just
All right, I'll chat you later in the week, guys.
I'll see you guys later. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye.